If a Creole marks it, it's very optional. It seems like it's just beginning to be marked. There is no Creole where that is really regularly done. And that's what we predict, because a language only decides to do that over time. So this is the nature of a Creole. Creole languages are mixtures, so there is this part. But then on the other hand, Creole languages started from pigeonhood, and so they're more streamlined than other languages are. They were pigeons, and then they got built back up, but we're only at X plus, say, 300 or 400 years, and so while they're complex, they are not as gunked up as a Russian, and there is reason why. When I say gunked up as a Russian, I don't mean a Russian human being. I've known many Russians, and very few of them were at all gunked up. I mean the Russian language itself. So, with that clear. Now, I am giving you a take on this that's based on a lot of my work and the work of some other people who work in the field. There have been other people who have gotten at this basic way of looking at it from different directions, and probably the pioneer in this was Derek Bickerton, who's at the University of Hawaii, and he can be argued to have put the study of Creole languages on the map back in the 1970s when he argued that Creole languages are the heart of grammar on view. His idea was that any older language has obscured all of this because of language change over time. Verbs going at the end of the sentence and sound changes and evidential markers. But his idea was that if there is an innate universal grammar in our heads that all languages share, then Creole languages are showing exactly what that looks like without all of the interference. And that's an interesting idea. This innate language capacity is a challenging concept for people who aren't initiated into the sub area of Chomskyan linguistics. But it's interesting stuff if you're patient enough to wrap your head around it. Bickerton's hypothesis was received with a great deal of, I would even say animosity by the industry, partly because the study of this universal grammar has a certain reputation. And the reason it has that reputation is partly because there seems to be a complete disconnection between it and anything that a living, breathing human being would enjoy about language. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. Like, to give you a little sense of the kind of universal grammar that people like Bickerton were referring to, imagine in your head the sentence, John kisses Mary often. And notice that, often is over there at the end. And then, if you say that in French, then you'll have Jean embrasse souvent Marie. And so John kisses often Mary. And that is the order that you have in English versus the order that you have in French. Now, we can try another pair of sentences, actually, that will illustrate this better. You can have John often kisses Mary. And then we'll have the French sentence be Jean embrasse souvent Marie. Now, you can't say in French Jean souvent embrasse Marie. You can't say John often kisses Mary in French. The often has to come after the verb. Now, if you are a Chomskyan, if you are many Chomskyans, then you say that what's going on is that the verb, in this case kiss or embrasse, started out after often, and then it moved under and popped up in between Jean and often, because it needed to be closer to the subject. And the reason that it needed to do that is because French is a language that has endings, and English doesn't have very many. And if you have the endings, then in order for that ending to be lit up, so to speak, actually in order for the verb to go get that ending, it has to go to that place and find it. So because English doesn't have many endings, the verb stays where it is. So John often kisses. But if you're speaking French, because it's an endings language, then you have originally Jean often kisses. But then it has to move up in between John and often to acquire legitimacy. Now, the idea is that that is actually something that is genetically specified in the neurons in our brains. It's a neat idea, and many people who are exposed to this are rather skeptical at first. Many people remain skeptical after having been exposed to such ideas for as long as 16 years. But there are many people who have built careers on that. So that, to a Chomskyan, is linguistics. And that, to a Chomskyan, is why we should be studying language. So Bickerton was saying that Creole languages represent this sort of thing naked and on view. And he was the one who studied the Hawaiian situation. And what he thought was that children in Hawaii of immigrant parents were only hearing this halting pidgin English spoken by their parents, and that this wasn't enough, and so they took all of that pidgin data and put it through this universal grammar component and came out with this naked, unaccreted expression of the human language competence. Bickerton gave this theory a name. It was called the bio program. You may think that that sounds exciting. You may think that sounds like the Jetsons, but it's known as the bio program hypothesis. Now, as with all aggressively phrased hypotheses, and Bickerton is a prickly man and a master rhetorician, people jumped on it and chipped at it, and over the years, some details, and I would say actually not some, but a lot of details have had to be revised about the idea. Bickerton supposed that the idea that Creole languages represent the innate grammatical inheritance was partly that all of the Creoles apparently have the same sort of grammar. But the fact is that a lot of the grammar in Creoles is not the same because it sprouted out of our heads. It's the same because of the fact that African languages, and the same ones were often spoken by the people who created all of these languages all over, for example, the Caribbean. So the similarities are due partly to the fact that these people all spoke certain similar original languages. And then Bickerton supposed that since Creoles are kind of what we have in our head originally, his idea was that there's a little bit of a Creole in all of us, he said that children should be expected to make Creole-like sentences on their way to learning any older language, that when they're not good at it yet, they should go through this Creole phase, reflecting what's really imprinted in their heads versus what you have to learn to actually speak a language that's full of exceptions to what's in your head. But the fact is that that's not how children talk. You know, as time goes on, it's clear that the grammar of Saramaccan is not something that kids go through before they learn Eskimo, Russian, or English. So that doesn't really work. But Bickerton is correct that Creoles are unique in being more streamlined than any other language. And they do have certain things in common that you can't explain on the basis of Africa. And so this was a different way of going at the way that I've chosen to explain it. But within Creole studies, the whole bio program idea is still often discussed, generally with more heat than light. But it's a player, so I wanted to present it to you. Now, anyway, one thing that I think we can be fairly sure of is that Creoles give us a sense, in grammatical terms, of what the first language would have been like. Now, we'll probably never know for sure, short of a time machine, but we can deduce that the first language probably did not have any kind of prefixes or suffixes because those take time to appear. Those always come from what started as independent words. And so why would it begin that way? If the first language couldn't begin with the prefixes and suffixes because it hadn't existed before it existed to have the free words become the affixes. So it would have been a language more like Chinese than like Russian. Then, because languages take time to kind of meow their way into inalienable possession and evidential marking and the sorts of things that we've seen, we can assume that the first language didn't have that. We can assume that these were human beings just like us who lived life just as immediately and richly as we do, but their language did not mark these persnickety, useless little distinctions that all of us feel anyway and have no reason to say. That's something that an older language does. It wouldn't have been ergative. We talked about how one of the languages in the Caucasus Mountains actually requires you to distinguish whether the subject is doing something to something or just sitting. So is the subject knitting a dress or is the subject just sleeping? Well, in many languages, you have to have a marker on the subject if it's knitting the dress or actually acting on something. We think, who cares? And I think so would speakers of the first language. That would not have been marked. Then, in general, we have a kind of a schoolhouse rock sense that there are nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, and that these things have markers. And so there's certain endings that you use with verbs, and then a lolly, 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 get your adverbs here. There's a li on the end of most adverbs and things like that. That is an English kind of thinking, though, because in languages that don't have as many of the prefixes and the suffixes, those sorts of differences are left more to context. Now, you see that in Creoles as well. So, for example, in Sranang, in Suriname, hebi means, big surprise, heavy. And so if you look in a word list, English Sranang, then heavy is marked as heavy. But you can have a sentence where what it means is the bag is heavy. Its weight is weighing me down. And the way you would say it in Sranang is asaka heavy. The bag is heavy. And then the weight is weighing me down. You would say a heavy, a heavy me. And so the heaviness is heavying me. Well, Sranang doesn't have as much of this machinery for showing the difference between these parts of speech with little bits of linguistic stuff, and it doesn't really have to. So, asaka heavy, a heavy me, means the bag is heavy, the weight is weighing me down. That is something that the first language would likely have paralleled. Probably what a noun and a verb and an adjective and an adverb were was more fluid in terms of what you could actually see in the typical sentence. So, Creoles are valuable to us for more reasons than the fact that they are just mixed languages. If the only thing we remember about Creoles is that they're mixed, then I'm afraid we're just being too ordinary. For the money that you've paid for this, you can get more out of Creoles than just that they are mixed together like Tutti Frutti ice cream. What is interesting about a Creole is not only the mixture, but the fact that these are the closest thing that we have to language starting again. These are uniquely streamlined languages. So they both mix and they get rid of the gunk. And they give us a sense of what language actually is at its heart, rather than what language rather accidentally becomes just because of the ravages of time. So now you are better informed about Creoles than most people in the world.
Lecture 31, Language Starts Over, The Creole Continuum.
This lecture is going to dwell on that eternal aspect of how things work in this world, which is the continuum concept. And this allows us to put our final touch on Creoles. And to then look at that final touch and get our final touch concept on how languages are distributed across the world. Just as language and dialect are actually continuum concepts in that dialects are related to one another to various degrees, and languages are therefore related to one another to various degrees to the extent that you consider there to be a such thing as a language. Creole is a continuum concept as well. And what I mean by that is that some Creoles are what are sometimes called deeper than others. Some people call a deeper Creole more radical. Some people would say that some Creoles are more Creole than others. And what is meant by that is that some Creoles are further. They are less like the language that provided most of their words than others. There's some Creoles where most of the words come from one language, but it is very much, in terms of its structure, a very different language. Then there's some Creoles that are closer to being an interesting version of that language that gave them their words. So we can go one more time back to Sranang, for example. Now, I gave a Sranang sentence earlier, which was, that hunter bought a house for his friend. And it came out as, Ahondi mandati, ben bai wan oso giamati. Now, just my saying that shows that this is not any kind of English. This is something quite different. If you hear this language spoken, your first impulse, if you weren't looking at it on the page and nobody had prepared you, would be to think that it was a Caribbean language or very, very possibly an African language. That's the way it sounds when it's rendered natively, which, of course, I am not. And the reason that it's so different is because it very much is English on an African pattern. So, for example, ahondimang dati. The dati is that, but most languages in the world do not have the sound th, so you're going to expect a substitution. D makes sense. So just like Ralph Crampton would say, give me that! Dat. Well, that's an easy substitution, so dot. And then it's dati because many languages in the world have a rule about how sounds are supposed to go. And that is that you have consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel. Now, some languages are not interested in that at all, but, for example, a Japanese is. And many West African languages have that kind of to, ke, re, do, pi, la structure instead of things like thick or something like splurge. These are sounds that just don't occur in sequences like that in many languages. So the languages that the people who created Stranong spoke were of that type. So you're not going to have that. You're not even going to have dot. The idea of it ending in a consonant is kind of foreign. In the same way as in English, you know that there's not going to be a word bnick, B-N-I-C-K. Somebody might say that if they're bored, but that, you know, that wouldn't work. No word would begin with bn. Well, in a language like this, no word is going to end in t. So you're going to have to add a vowel. So dati. And then in the same way, the ending word of this is mati, yamati, to his mate. And mate comes out mati, because you're never going to just end mate. In Stranong, that leaves you waiting for that other shoe to drop. Meta, meto, mate something, mati, like that. So, then we also saw that the way that this sentence strings verbs together, buy a house, give his friend, is something that's modeled on how West African grammar works. So, this is quite exotic compared to English. If one mastered this grammar, you'd have to wrap your head around some very new things. But all Creoles are not as deep as that one. That is, all Creoles are not as far from the language that gave them words. And sometimes that's only clear if we take a closer look at the language. So on the island of Mauritius, which is off of Madagascar, which is off of the southeast coast of Africa, there is a French Creole spoken. It is similar in many ways to Haitian Creole, which is another French Creole, and it was created via the same kind of plantation system that Haitian was. Now, if you're going to say they were going in Mauritian Creole, then we, if we've learned French, know that they were going is ils allaient. So, il is they, and aller is the verb to go, aller, except with an ending which connotes the imperfect and in the past. And so, ils allaient. Now, that's fine. But then, in Mauritian Creole, it's zot ti pe aller. So, zot ti pe aller. Now, that seems nothing like ils allaient. Ils allaient is two words. Mauritian has four. Zot ti pe aller. Now, the zot means they, then ti is the past, then pe gives you the sense that it was going on over a period of time, then there's aller. Now this seems completely different from ils allaient, and so you look at zot ti pe aller and you think, well, this is something exotic. This is a Creole language, completely different. This must have something to do with Africans, etc., etc. But actually, you have to think about not the standard French that people speak in court, or people speak in school, but you have to think about the kind of French that black people brought to Mauritius were most likely to actually hear. And once again, we return to the point that if you were living a comfortable life in France, particularly in the 17 and 1800s, then you have no reason to uproot yourself and go to some remote hot island. And remember, this is before travel was sexy. These are people with no airplanes. Getting there takes a while. Coming back takes a while. And also something that we tend to forget, there's no such thing as air conditioning. And I'm almost not being facetious. Imagine a world where the only way to get cool was to have some poor person fan you, and you know they're only going to do that for so long. So going to a really hot place meant you were going to be hot all the time. That's a major technological difference between then and today. So why would you go to Mauritius? So chances are that if you're going to go to Mauritius and stay, you've got some kind of problem. Life isn't being good to you in France, or maybe somebody sends you to Mauritius. So if you were that kind of person, then chances are that society has not been kind to you, and chances are that you do not speak the Queen's French, so to speak. You probably speak one of the non-standard dialects. So if you are in France, one kind of dialect that you heard would render they were going quite differently from ils allaient. For example, you might hear eux autres étaient après aller. Now, eux autres is they others. And for those of you who know Spanish, think about nosotros and vosotros. If you have a kind of language sense, if you think about it, just like if you think about understand and you realize that it's under and stand. If you think about nosotros, the otros means others, and originally there was just nos, so it's kind of like we others. It's kind of like in non-standard English the way you might say we uns. You don't need that uns, we know what we means. In the same way, it used to be nos and vos in Spanish, and then there was nosotros, vosotros, so we others, you others. Well, there's some French dialects where the same thing happens, nous autres instead of nous. This is the new word that is no longer used much, but when it was, nous autres, or instead of vous, you in the plural, there are French dialects where you say vous autres, kind of you others. Well then, in they, eux autres. So, if you take eux autres, and then you think about it being really said, you don't deal with French's whacked out spelling, where it looks kind of like eux autres, that's ridiculous. It's eux autres. Now, say it fast. Zotre. Faster. Zotre. Now your mouth is full. Zotre. So it's just zotre. Well, Mauritius has this Creole where the word is zotre. So you imagine if you're a slave, you have no sense of aux autres on the page. That's artificial. What you're hearing is people running around and saying, zotre. Well, then you come up with, oh, I think I understand that word. He says zotre. And so there you have the word zotre. Or it's eux autres étaient après aller. What that means is they were after going. There are many languages where to say that something is happening in a given time, you use after. That's not something we do in English, but it's eux autres étaient, they were après aller, after going. So, étaient. Now, on the page in French, it's étaient. It's absolutely frightening that you have those three symbols to indicate just one sound. But étaient had nothing to do with what the Mauritian slave heard. Heard étaient. Or he might have really heard té. He might have heard di. And so, zot, ti, and then in the same way, après becomes pe, and then there's aller, which is actually fine. So next thing you know, what you have is regional French, which is perfectly processable if you're familiar with standard French, zotre était après aller, and it becomes zotre était après aller, and then it becomes zot ti pe aller. So, zot ti pe aller. All of which is to say that Mauritian Creole, once you know what kind of French that the slaves were hearing, is not as far from French, or anything you would call French, as Sranang is from English. It's a Creole in many ways, but it's not as far away as something like Pays Bende, where have you been in Sranang. So, now on the other hand, there are also languages where they're so close to the language that provided their words, although different enough to not be that language, that there's some people who call them semi-creoles. There's kind of an in-between stage. So, for example, on the island of Réunion, which is also off of Madagascar, Réunion has a kind of creole of its own. But it was created under different conditions than in Mauritius. In Mauritius, to oversimplify the story, but only somewhat, there were plantations set up, and a whole bunch of Africans were brought from West and East Africa to work the plantations. So suddenly, you had 100 Africans to every one white person. Now, what that meant was that learning any kind of French was pretty hard, because how are you all going to share that one person? And more to the point, you're talking more to each other than you ever are to anybody white. So what's going to form is you guys' thing, not the way they're talking over in the House. And, of course, remember that these are not people who have any reason to want to speak metropolitan continental French. They just want to talk to each other. So Réunion was different. It had a different kind of history where at first you had Malagasy people from Madagascar. It wasn't Africans until later, who were brought in to be less slaves than servants. And often there would be a small house and some planting being done around the house. And the whites and the Malagasies would live side by side. There were about as many Malagasies as there were whites on one of these homesteads, as they've been called. And often all of the people slept in the same bed. So what this means is that, one, you can hear a lot more French. Two, you're inclined more to speak it because you know the people who you're living with. You spend all this time with them. You talk to them as much as you talk to other Malagasies or to yourself. As you might imagine, the evidence is that a lot more went on than talking in many of these situations, and that kind of relationship also means that you're going to talk more like one another than you're going to talk if you are in the house and the other person is way off in the field and never meets you. That does not bring people together linguistically. So, as a result, there is not a Creole proper spoken on Réunion. Eventually, more slaves were brought in, and it became a more typical plantation economy, but by then, the language pattern had been set. So if you look at a sentence of Réunionnais, semi-Creole French, then what you see is something that's not quite French, but you don't quite want to call it a different language. So, for example, one sentence would be, then my father always said to me. So, alors, then, mon papa, my father, always said to me, l'a toujours dit à moi. Now, what that comes out as in standard French would be a toujours dit, always said, has always said, à moi, to me. Now, in standard French, you wouldn't have this à moi. What you would have would be m'a toujours dit, where the M is put at the beginning, and that means to me. So it would be to me, has always said. And the fact that you have to take that m and take it from where it kind of should be after the verb, say to me, and bring it to the beginning like that is a quirk of Romance languages that many of us are familiar with. That's a kind of a complication. Réunionnais irons that out, and so it's l'a toujours dit à moi. And so it's different. No French person would say it, but it makes a certain amount of sense. And the la is a in French. But again, no big difference. I remember one night in Paris. No, I was in Aix-en-Provence. And I honestly forget why, but I was rambling the streets with a friend of mine at 4 a.m. And somehow we ran in with some locals, with some natives. And around 5 in the morning, we were in this bustling cafe, and somehow we got onto the topic of Creoles. And they were just laymen, so they didn't look at it the way I and my Creolist friend did. And I remember the guy saying over and over again, Réunionnais, it is just a dialect. It is just a dialect. No, actually, some people say it's a different, no, it's a dialect. And of course, he was speaking French, but so he was not speaking English in a silly accent. But that happened. So to him, he understands Réunionnais, but what he hears it as is a kind of French. He probably understands less of it than he thinks. So, Réunionnais is considered a semi-Creole. It doesn't have grammatical gender, no gender markers, no les and las. It doesn't have a plural suffix, that's gone. And it usually uses a bit of stuff put before the verb rather than using the verb suffixes. Réunionnais doesn't like that. No normal French is like that. So Réunionnais is different. But it's Frenchier than Sranang or Tokpisin are Englishy, to use the official terminology, of course, Frenchy and Englishy. So that's what we call a semi-Creole. There's another semi-Creole which has a very important status, which is Afrikaans in South Africa. Afrikaans is spoken far from where it originated, which technically would have been as Dutch, which is spoken in Holland. And Afrikaans has moved far enough away from Dutch that it is a separate language, but it's not just different from Dutch, the way, for example, Frisian or even English are. It's also, in a way, and I could get shot by some South African philologist for saying this, but it's because it's true. It's simpler than Dutch. And the reason that it's simpler than Dutch is because South Africa has a history where, for one thing, a lot of the people who we often know as Bushmen, or the Khoi, more technically, learned the language as a second language. And there were also other people brought in who were learning Dutch as a second language, often taking care of kids and passing on their way of speaking to the kids, which is something that also happened with Gullah in the South in the United States. So as a result, Afrikaans is certainly not a Creole in the sense that Sranang is, but it's also more streamlined than any form of Dutch, even non-standard Dutch, is today. So, for example, Afrikaans does not have past suffixes at all. And that kind of thing is hard in a Germanic language. So we have things like sing, sang. So it's not singed, it's sang. You just have to know that it's think, thought. What happened to thinked? But then stink, stank, and then all sorts of things. Dive, is it dove? Well, probably not, but notice that that sounds almost right. It's because English strong verb past marking is very difficult, and it's difficult because it's very arbitrary. You have all these sorts of switches that where you just kind of have to know. Well, if you are a foreign learner of English, that's one of the first things you're going to get rid of if you can get away with it. And so no big surprise, Afrikaans just gets rid of all the past like that, and you always just say, I have gone, I have seen, where you don't have to deal with the vowels kind of jumping around. No gender in Afrikaans. A good Germanic language, one that behaves itself and gets dessert, will have as many as three genders. And so good old German with its der, die, and das, with its multisexual silverware. Then there's some that only have two, like Dutch. Then there's English, which is bizarre, which has no gender. Afrikaans is bizarre in that way, too. So that's another semi-Creole. And then Creoles exist on continua in general. So sometimes there is no one variety of the Creole. Instead, there's a deepest variety, and then there's the language that gave it its words, and then you can just slide in between the two on various levels. So in a way, the Creole is kind of a series of shells expanding outward from the nucleus of the atom, so to speak. I was told that that whole shell model of the atom actually is not true. And that's a shame because it's so useful in terms of illustration and things. So let's pretend that it's true, the shells in an atom. So, for example, if you go to Guyana, there are so many ways to say, I gave him, that you might be pardoned for at first thinking that this is a language with no structure at all. And this is what many people used to think. You can say, for I gave him, I give ye. You can say, me bin gi am. You can say, me digi ye. You can say, I gave ye, and so on and so on. And many people will tell you this and laugh, but then you're not laughing inside because you're thinking, this is a language? Well, actually, it turns out that what all of these versions of the sentence are is increasing approximations of the standard English form, starting from something which is quite different, reminiscent of Sranang, and then becoming just standard English with a Guyanese accent. And of course, there's nothing wrong with an accent, so that's just a kind of English. So it starts with mi bin giam, and the bin is the past marker. You see that same past marker with a different vowel in Sranang. Instead of give, it's gi, and that leaves off the final consonant, and then you have am. And so mi bin giam. Then as you move closer, you have mi bin gii, mi bin gii. Then mi digi e, I digi e, I did gi e, I did give he, I did give he, I gave he, I gave him, I gave him, I gave he, I gave him, I gave him, I gave him. So it goes like that. So when you start out, you have something kind of like Sranang. In the middle, you have something like I did gi e, and the did is not as weird as it seems, because in many early dialects of English, non-standard dialects, you did use did like that. I did give him that book. And so that's what that's modeled on. And pretty soon, you've actually got the standard. And this kind of continuum is common, particularly in the English-speaking Caribbean, Louisiana Creole French is like that as well. Cape Verdean is like that. There's some varieties that are very different from Portuguese. There's some that practically are Portuguese, and there's a shading in between. So the middle of the continuum can be argued to be dialects. So you can speak Guyanese Creole in a way that is really just kind of a funky way of speaking English. But once you get to the other end of the continuum, you really are speaking something quite different. Generally, the better you speak that version at the other end of the continuum, the less education, the less exposure to wider society you will have had. Whereas if you are a Guyanese whose life happens to have kept one in the capital and given one higher education, etc., chances are that you can maybe fake that other end of the continuum, but you probably don't live in it. And then different people fall at different points along it. Nobody speaks only one level of that continuum at all times. So it's all a very human thing. But it's very much there. I remember I was at a conference once when I was much earlier in my career. I was like 7, and I was with my dissertation advisor, and he was, and I assume still is, Guyanese, and we were walking along talking about whatever people talk about at conferences, and another Guyanese linguist came up to us. And they hadn't seen each other for a while, so they started talking. And this actually happened. We walked to the elevator, and it was one of those hotels that's like 7 miles tall, and I was staying in a room with my dissertation advisor, because a good dissertation advisor does that for students who are still poor. And so we were going up to our room, which was on like the 580th floor, so it was a long, long elevator ride. And this other Guyanese person got in with us. When we were in the lobby and the doors closed, they were joking in English. But joking has a way of bringing out your more indigenous ways of speaking. And so as the elevator went up, and it seemed like we were in it for like a half hour. It was literally probably about 1 minute. The further we went up, the more they started going along this continuum until by the time we got up to our floor, they were not speaking any kind of English. Gradually, I lost the thread. By about floor 10, I was thinking, boy, these accents sure are getting thick. Then by like 425, it was, you know, I didn't quite catch those last couple of words. Then by floor 50, it was, am I having a stroke? And then by floor 75, I realized they're not speaking English, but they're not from India. You know, last time I checked, they're not Fijians, they're from Guyana. So this must be the Creole. And by floor 100, I felt kind of left out and insufficiently indigenous myself. And tears were rolling down my cheeks. Now, there's a great deal of exaggeration in that story, except for the fact that they did travel a whole lot of the continuum as the elevator went up. So that is the nature of the continuum. I didn't cry. Anyway, the whole world is a continuum in that way in terms of language. So now we see that that's how Creoles work. And now we can look at how all language works, including this part in the picture, and equipped with the knowledge that this part is not just bad speech and not just endless variation and not just slang, but it's a systematic relationship between one form of language and another. But for example, what's Spanish? Now, to many of us, Spanish is either what somebody we know and love speaks, or it's Speedy Gonzales, or it's something we took in school and never got as good at as we would have liked. That's probably what Spanish is for most of us. What is Spanish? Well, first we start in Spain. It's a bundle of dialects. Castilian Spanish is one dialect. That one happens to have gotten into the books. But there are other dialects in Spain. Now, if you think of a map, then you know that Portugal is next door to Spain. And if you picture the map, you realize that the boundary between Portugal and Spain is just artificial, and that in terms of land, really we're just dealing with Iberia. So as we would expect, Spanish shades into Portuguese, particularly through varieties like Galician. And so if we were not dealing with two separate, quote-unquote, nations on Iberia, then we would just think of Spanish and Portuguese as variations on the same thing. They're partly mutually intelligible, and especially that's the case on the page. Then in the New World, because of the Spanish colonial phase, there are hundreds of dialects of Latin American Spanish. They differ from Castilian Spanish on all levels, not only words, but in the sound system. So the Castilian th is not in Latin America. And then there are all sorts of grammatical differences. And so that's a whole different bunch of Spanishes. But then in Ecuador, this Latin American Spanish mixed with Quechua and became this media lengua that we talked about. And actually, I didn't want to overburden you with detail, but there's a kind of a continuum. There are media lenguas that are pure Quechua with just Spanish words. Then in between, there are various varieties where Spanish plays more of a part in the grammar. So that's the way generally things go. So media lengua is an extreme. There are two Spanish creoles in the New World. One of them is Papiamentu, which is spoken in Curaçao. And then another one is spoken in Colombia, as in Colombia, in a small town called El Palenque de San Basilio. And it is spoken by slaves who escaped to that place from the coast and founded their own communities. Palenquero is slowly dying, it seems, at this point. And it was only actually discovered in the early 1970s. But it is there. Then, in the Philippines, there are Spanish creoles. Many of them seem to be endangered, but they are there. They seem to be a kind of a dialect complex, so they're not completely separate languages. They seem to be variations on one thing, but the variation is pretty wide. And so they are there. Then in the United States, there's a new dialect of Spanish forming that has a great many English words and some influence from English grammar. That's all that Spanglish is. We associate it with the nitty-gritty of real life and how people evaluate these things and the Spanish we've seen on the page. But really, the Martian looking would say there's a new kind of Spanish mixing in new ways, just like media lengua did, just like Papiamentu and Palenquero and the Philippines Creoles did. Now there's this new Spanish. So that is what Spanish is. Spanish starts out, we want to remember, as one of a bunch of variations on Latin that happened to form in Europe, which is only considered a continent because such big stuff went down there. If you look at a map, Europe actually is just one part of Eurasia. It's just a peninsula, really. But if we're going to call Europe a continent, then Spanish was just one version of Latin that happened in one little part of what is really just one little peninsula of Asia. And so that happens to have spread because of unusual colonial proclivities of its people a long time ago. Just think Spain. You know, think of what Spain is now and then what Spain was then. There was a time when the Spanish and the Portuguese ruled the world. Truly amazing. It's a fun fact. But in any case, that's all that Spanish was. Now it's spread all over the place, and of course it's changed. All sorts of varieties of Spanish bleed into varieties of other things, and then you've got creoles of Spanish that are affected by other languages to varying extents. Portuguese exists not only in Portugal, but in Brazil and Africa, and South and Southeast Asia. And then the one in Brazil has semi-creole varieties. The Brazilian Portuguese of most people in Brazil is quite different from the continental Portuguese that one might learn in a book. And then there are various Portuguese creoles, and they exist on the west coast of Africa. They exist in India and a lot more than one. And then there are various ones in Indonesia. All of these vary in terms of how Portuguese they are, how indigenous they are, and this is a reality for a great many quote-unquote languages in the world. I could say the same sorts of things about Dutch and German in particular. All people speak complex varieties of language. They differ in a clinal continuum sense from one another, and are often very difficult to assign to tidy classes. But this is the wonder of what language is really like.
Lecture 32. What is Black English?
Black English. before we proceed to the final four lectures, I thought that we might take a break and take a look at the non-standard English dialect that's probably the most immediate to Americans, especially these days. When we go through a course like this, it's all well and good to have some insights about Beowulf and to know what Semitic is and to know about Creoles. But it's also important to have new ways of looking at linguistic phenomena that are around you every day. So one example of that was the blackboard grammar digression that we did in one of the lectures. And in this case, I think that hitting the Ebonics topic is equally important because, not to sound remotely high and mighty or to imply that linguists are some sort of rarefied caste, but only if you understand the things that you now understand based on these previous lectures could you really parse the Ebonics controversy of 1996-97 and really understand what Black English is. It's a very particular and very peculiar subject, and we now have the tools to understand it. In any case, I'm going to call it Black English. There is a tendency among academics nowadays to call it African American Vernacular English. That gets shortened to AV. I find that just a rather aesthetically unpleasant acronym, and I grew up calling it Black English, and that's what I'm going to call it. Some people also have called it Black English Vernacular. And then I think that for better or for worse, the term Ebonics, which has always sounded to me like a medical procedure that women on Park Avenue underwent in the 40s, is stuck with us. But I'm not going to call it Ebonics. It's going to be called Black English. In any case, it's often thought that Black English refers to slang only. And of course, this is what kind of sticks out. And so, for example, there's the colorful language that we know from rap music. When I used to talk about this, I used to use Funky Fresh as an example of the slang. I think that shows how long I've been talking about this. I don't think anybody's saying that anymore. But I think one slang expression that I have picked up over the past couple of years is fashizzle. Fashizzle apparently is a cute way of saying for sure. That is a bit of slang. And, of course, that will be gone soon and will very nicely make this set obsolete. Or off the hook. Someone might say that lemonade was off the hook. That doesn't mean that the lemonade was ever appended to a hook. It means that it was off the hook like a telephone. Anyway, off the hook means really good. So slang like that. But Black English is more than that. And, in fact, the slang is the least interesting part of it in terms of seeing things that are systematic, that are correspondent to other linguistic phenomena in the world. The slang is decoration. It's pretty, it's funny, it's interesting, it's vulgar, it's annoying, whatever it is. That comes, it goes, it's just the icing. But Black English is also a sound system. And this is something that people often are kind of confused about. Black English is a non-standard, but not substandard, dialect. And as a result, it has a different sound system than the standard dialect. And that is why we perceive there as being something like a black sound. And spelling, orthography, have a way of distorting what the issue of the sound system is. So, for example, in Black English, one might say with instead of with. Now, we very understandably think, well, it leaves off a letter because there's with. And then there's with, which has four letters. But if you think about it, language is not about letters. And we know that the English spelling system is a monstrosity. Think about them just as sounds. Pretend you're the preliterate villager. With, with. Now, if you think about it, on both of those words, there's one sound at the end. F, f. Now, we see th on the page, but you don't say th. There's no to anything in th. I'm doing one thing. Th. I'm sticking my tongue between my teeth. So th, th. So that means that whereas standard English happens to have th, Black English has th. It doesn't really leave anything off. It just makes something different. So the spelling kind of confuses us. In standard French, there's the word charbon, and that's coal. In Norman French, it's carbon. Now, one might think that Norman French leaves off a sound because it has just C instead of CH. But again, sh, k, sh, k. They're both one thing. So spelling can be very misleading. Then, in other cases, it's not just a change, but there are times when Black English's sound system is more complex than English's. And so, for example, Bill in Standard English, but then in Black English it comes out more like Bill, Bill. Well, that's a diphthong. So that's something that verges on being two sounds, so that's more. Now, of course, there are cases where Black English's system is simpler, and so if you have West in Standard English, that will often be Wes in Black English. But really, these things kind of balance each other out. If a Martian came down and listened to the young Negro speaking, and then listened to Bill O'Reilly speaking, then the Martian would just think, the Negro speaks differently than Bill O'Reilly. Simple as that. So, different sounds. Then, there is grammar. Now, in some places, Black English grammar is simpler than standard. I wonder what feature I'm going to choose. How about the verb to be? And so, for example, in Black English, you might say, she my sister. And obviously, something has been left out. Like in Russian. So, in Russian, она моя сестра. She's my sister, and there is no to be in a sentence like that. Chekhov was not unsophisticated, and Boris Yeltsin is unsophisticated, but Chekhov was not unsophisticated, and therefore neither is Black English in this. It's just one of many language varieties that leaves it out. Cantonese does as well, but that is simpler. Elsewhere, Black English kind of comes out ahead, and the be verb is useful here as well. So, for example, if you hear somebody say, she be walking to the store, that does not mean that somebody in a dress is walking in front of you to the store right then. That is actually erroneous Black English. What she be walking to the store means is that she does it on a regular basis. The be is a habitual marker of all things. Now, it's not that people are conscious of this. Very few African Americans, I would say no African American who hasn't had a little bit of linguistics would be able to tell you that that's how be is used. Just like most of us don't know what the difference between and the is in usage, although we use it properly all day long every day. But if you look at how be is used, it's like that. If the person is walking in front of you, then it's she walk into the store right now. You would never point out the window and say, look, she be walking to the store. That would be wrong. That would be using the grammar in the wrong way. Now, in English, when we have the habitual, we indicate it by not doing anything. And so we would say, she walks to the store every Tuesday. And even if I didn't say every Tuesday, if I say she walks to the store, that does not mean that she's doing it now. Imagine I point out a window and I say, look, she walks to the store. It's like I got hit in the head. It's, look, she's walking to the store. Only the foreigner would point out the window and say, oh, look, she walks to the store. And we think that that's picturesque in the foreigner, but it's also wrong. So we just have the bare verb for the habitual. And then in Black English, you have this marker, be. So Black English is more explicit about that than Standard English. So that's not just hocus pocus or mumbo jumbo or political theatrics. That's really the linguistic facts about Black English and how it works. So, it is another dialect of English rather than some sort of bastardization of the language. And so just like there's Norman French, there's the French of Picardy, there are the Frenches of many places. There is the English of Brooklyn, there's the English of Cornwall, there is the English of Black. And it's just one of those. Any associations we have otherwise are based on the fact that languages and dialects are spoken in societies, and obviously there are racial tensions and racial issues that will color, so to speak, our views. But in terms of these two dialects, Standard and Black English on paper, the difference between them, or the qualitative relationship between them, is much different than we're often led to think by visceral impressions, by misimpressions, by a media that doesn't have enough time to do justice to the facts, etc. So, however, back in 96 and 97, we were told by particularly members of the Oakland School Board that Black English is an African language with English words. And I think most of us heard that and thought, yeah, it didn't seemed like it. I thought it was English. And we were told by many people, some of them PhDs who should have known better, that we could not trust our ears on this, that there was something mystical going on that you could only understand if you were a linguist. Well, after this course, you can come to your own conclusions about that. And the conclusions are these. If Black English were an African language, well, we've seen what happens when a European language becomes an African language in terms of its grammar. This was Creoles. And so we remember Sranang of Suriname, where the hunter bought a house for his friend, is Ahondi Mandati Ben Baiwan Oso Giemati. Now, that doesn't sound anything like any statement we've ever heard from the mouth of a Black person born in the United States. That's not what Black English sounds like. We would not have, even to give it a fairer shake, Black English with something like, the hunter that Ben Baiwan house give his friend. That would be modeled on African structure. But that's not the way Black people in the United States talk. And so obviously the African analysis doesn't quite work. Now the people who were saying this did not just pull that idea completely out of the air. They noticed that, for example, you can leave the third person singular S ending off in Black English. And so you have I walk, you walk, the way he walk, then we walk, y'all walk, they walk. So that's possible, and then all of a sudden you have this endingless language, at least in the verbs. And of course that might remind you of African languages, many of which slaves spoke, many of which are languages that do not have suffixes in the way that an Indo-European language has them. So, if it's true that in Yoruba you would say, I walk, you walk, he, she, it walk, we walk, you all walk, they walk, and then in Black English it seems to be the same pattern, it's reasonable to think, well, then there must be something African going on. It's also reasonable to then do further and more detailed analysis. That was not always the case with those who were propounding that Black English was an African language. And then there are other things that you think about, such as that while you can say the way he walk, you can also say in other grammatical contexts, and this is very complex in Black English in itself, but you can also say I walks to the store. You know, don't be making fun of the way I walks. So there you go. It just seems that the S moved. It's not necessarily that it doesn't exist in the language. But in general, Black English is a dialect where there are no verbs run together, like in Sranang. No such thing as the hunter that and things like that. Basically, Black English is as we hear English. The counterintuitive is always compelling in a science. It's always great to find out that your ears are not working the way they should, that something's going on that you would never expect. But in the case of whether or not African Americans are speaking English, I think I would be inclined to say that African Americans are speaking English. And one indication that you have of that is that this is a dialect that retains a great deal of the irregular, bric-a-brac, frustrating, why does it have to be that way mess that standard English has. So, for example, there are plurals like man, men, foot, feet. Why? We've kind of seen why. That doesn't make these things any less frustrating for the foreigner. Well, Black English does not have mans. Black English doesn't have foots. If you're a Creole language where you've really gone African and English has only been learned partially, and remember that Creoles are as much about reduction of structure as they are about mixture, then you don't have men and feet. That's the hard stuff. That's the first thing you're going to get rid of. But in Black English, there is men and there is feet. In Black English, you do not have anyone saying, I goed to the store yesterday. You know, you have I went. No African American has trouble with the fact that there is this irregularity. Nobody standed in Black English. You stood. Nobody thinked. You thought. These are irregularities. We don't think about them, but anybody else who learns English has to. And Black English is full of those things. And so it's obvious that however the language was created, however the dialect was created, it was created within a context where English got through pretty fully. It wasn't that there was this grand transformative process. So it's not an African language, Black English. It is a non-standard dialect of English, but Africa had, as we will see, a very distant relationship to the dialect, despite the color of the skin of its speakers. Now, there is also a kind of controversy about the history of Black English. Many have argued that Black English began as a Creole, if we want to talk about the history of the language. And it's hard to chart the history of Black English because Black English is a non-standard dialect. We're all aware that in many ways it's a very stigmatized dialect. And as a result, while the dialect was forming, people were not inclined to write down the Negroes are developing an interesting new way of talking. They weren't even inclined to write down the Negroes are developing a disgusting new way of talking and here is its grammar. There was no such thing. No one really cared how the Negroes were talking. People were doing things like writing the Declaration of Independence and things like that. So you have the occasional quick passage of how a Black person was speaking, often caricatured, so you're not sure if you can trust it. And really, that's about all you've got once you go back before, really, about 1960, because only since the second half of the 20th century, when academia made what was at first a healthy tilt to the left and became more interested in charting the diversity among different people, including those down below, that Black English became an object of study. So now there is a thriving industry of academic Black English study. That was not true before, and only occasionally was it written about, and generally not with the kind of standards of accuracy that a linguist would desire today. So it's an open field as to figuring out what the history was, and many people have said that